Chapter 27. They bundled under their sleeping bag when the cold became too much, and tried not to think about what might be in the bag with them. It was very cold in the early morning hours, even when Sigma had scraped forward to the head of the car and sprawled out above their heads as a windbreak. They packed in tight, sharing warmth, not thinking too hard about the bag's vileness, and waited for the sun to find them. They arrived at Chicago after the world had brightened. The speed of the train reduced considerably as they came into the press of buildings, and it was a long, restless wait to come close enough to the yard where it was safe to disembark. When the train was on the thick bundle of arterial tracks that plunged into the heart of the yard, they jumped off on the south side, scurried across, ducked behind a row of Connex containers, and then, when they were sure they had not been seen, jumped the low fence to 16th Street. They had to lower themselves down a wall to get to the street on the other side, so Sigma went first, dropping thoughtlessly to the dirt with a rattle, and then turned to help Giles and Dora down. When he was down, Giles saw the wall. It was covered in more of the graffiti, like the yard in Amarillo, but looking closer here, he could see something more beneath the riot. He saw eyes, great eyes as large as his own head, deliberate lines, shapes, and colors. He thought there was a woman's blue face buried beneath the mess, a giant face taller than Sigma. He wished he could have seen her without all the shit piled over. He thought she must have been lovely once. They legged across the street, keeping low in the bright morning, though no one was about. On the other side was a small warehouse building of the new style, with receptive walls like black mirrors, but Giles could tell the moment he saw it that it was abandoned some time ago. It was a thing from the new world made old already, as all abandoned things appeared. All abandoned things appeared old and tired, waiting patiently for the wrecker crews to come. Sigma broke the lock on the front door quite easily. When they were inside, they spent some time looking for an outlet for him, but had no luck. All copper had been stripped from the walls before their arrival. They found a corner to occupy, and Giles draped the sleeping bag over some old desks and began to beat it with a stick. Dora pulled out some food to share, and Giles was honest enough to tell her he was now glad they had taken it. It was still horrible, and tasted mainly of salt and preservatives, but it was good to have, and filled the hole. Unable to share their meal, Sigma shut all the way down to dormancy, leaving only a skeleton system online for the lenses. Giles sat down next to Dora and struggled to ignore the sounds of movement beyond the walls, the glances of the other vagrants as they peered around the corners.
"You go ahead and sleep first," Dora said. "I got enough on the train."
Giles still felt like they were on the train. His head throbbed with the shaking they had left behind, and his body still felt it. There was a buzzing in his mind that had nothing to do with the nodes. It was the buzz of silence, now louder to him than the hours of banging and screeching wheels. He wanted to tell her there was no way he could possibly sleep, that she should try first. But then his eyes, which were red and burning, drifted shut on their own. He experienced them closing as an outsider, feeling them curiously as they slipped shut. He laughed softly inside himself and disabled the overlay. When it was gone, the world turned and rolled over itself, and he felt the shaking of the train now like gentle rocking. The world rocked around him, and he tried to experience the rocking, to pay great attention to it because it was wonderful. He slipped away shortly after. When night came, they skirted the boundary of the train yard as before, and found another dark back alley ditch with a trash pile to wedge into. There was always another trash pile in a back alley ditch, left always in those places where the vagrants needed them. Giles wondered about that as they waited. A freighter bound for Syracuse came through a little after 10:30. They watched it in silence, nearly broke cover when it rolled forward, but then hunkered back when the train stopped again. There was the usual banging all up and down the line as this happened, and Dora said,
"They're latching more cars to the back. Relax, it'll be a while yet."
She was right. There were another 30 minutes in the hole watching the line hitch and stop, hitch and stop. When it was finally moving for good, they watched to make sure it would continue, and after that they had to wait for a bull to pass. The beam of light that projected from his hand jigged and prodded everywhere like a rooting mutt.
"We're too close to the yard," Giles whispered. "Listen to the expert now."
"We're closer than you said we should be.
I know. There are some homes south of here, though. You don't want to camp someone's backyard. They'll run you out faster than anything. You have the lenses. Say when it's good to go.
They nearly ran out of train before the timing was right. When he thought the distance between the nearest bull and the passing train was enough, he nudged her. Dora said,
"Not bad. Those are boxcars on the end. Get ready for a much more comfortable ride."
She came out of the shadows without warning, and Giles was left to follow after with Sigma, stutter stepping over garbage to catch her up. She passed into the gravel without slowing, bounded over the first line of empty track, and Giles saw her stoop and scrounge among the ties. He came up beside her, hunkered low with every bodily sense warning him they were seen, and consulted the overlay again to confirm there were no security on the way.
"What the hell are you doing?" he hissed.
She had something long and black in her hands, sharp at one end. It was maybe half the length of her forearm. She only said, "Come on," and was up again, running toward the train. She angled for a boxcar pulling ahead, and then veered right to follow it as it rolled slowly on. She came close enough to get a good, long look at the door, then slowed as if she had seen something new.
"What? What is it?" "That door's been wedged already," she said.
She dropped the thing in her hand, and it rang dully against the scrabble. Giles looked down and saw it was a rail spike.
"Someone's in that car."
"No," Giles said. "I'd see them." "No, Giles. The decibel level of the train masks whatever might be within. I would not be able to pick up a heartbeat if it was there." They stood out in the open, silhouetted under the moonlight, and watched the car as it rolled away.
"Dora, hang on, I'm thinking."
"No time. There's a guard maybe 300 yards away. He's coming."
"God damn it," she said,
and began to trot after the car. When they reached it, Sigma ran ahead to shove the sliding door open further, and then locked it in place with an arm. He gestured with his other for them to climb in. Dora boosted into the car easily, froze for a second as she looked into the rear where Giles could not see, and then turned to beckon at him with both hands. He looked down the train's length to the tail, saw the guard was still a safe distance away, and nodded. He ran to the car, glanced down at the door track for something to grab and pull against, and saw a rail spike like the one Dora had dropped, wedged into the track against the door's closure.
"Come on already," she said.
His first attempt ended in his torso laying half into the car, hands palming frantically across the boards before he slipped out again. His feet twisted, and he began to go down, and as he tilted, his eyes caught sight of the gleaming track and the cold steel wheels rolling over it. He saw how close he was to the wheels and realized they looked much more like guillotines when he was right on top of them. But now he was going down, and he felt his belly lurch, and there was only the split second to wonder if he could roll away safely or if the wheels would take his legs. He tensed to roll before Sigma grabbed him by the shirt back and hauled him up to his feet.
"You must take her hand," Sigma insisted.
He glanced up and saw Dora squatted down low, hips and pelvis thrust into the night air with a hand out, and beyond her, there were faces huddled gray and dim in the shadows. One of them grimaced and said,
"Hurry up, damn you!"
He reached, and then she was yanking him upward, both hands, and he coming off his feet weightless. He marveled at her strength before she slung him down on the boards and turned to Sigma.
"Let's go, big boy!"
Sigma placed his hand on the inner edge of the door, his other on the floor, and braced. From somewhere beyond the boxcar's walls, she heard a crack, and Sigma's shoulder exploded in a spray of shrapnel. It stung Dora's face as it went out everywhere, and she closed her eyes against it, blinking then to check that she could still see. When she looked back at Sigma, the turret was pointed away from the train. His left hand still clutched the runner. His entire right arm lay disembodied on the boards at her feet.
"Caution! Extreme caution!"
Dora leaned past the sliding door and searched the ditch. Back toward the tail, from the very place they had just vacated, she saw the gray light shape, all arms and legs like a spider rushing over gravel, hitching along uneven ground, head lowered like a creature that tracked by scent, lowered so she could not see the head in the darkness, and saw only the hard angles of the elbows and knees as he skittered like a crab, and he came on faster than she could imagine, eating up the distance in those jerking strides. Her throat went dry as she watched him come. One of the arms disappeared against the body, becoming a dark flipper under the moon as the torso swung, and then it was out again, pointing the way ahead, and the hand flashed orange-red fire. Sparks jumped from Sigma's rear carapace, and he, still running, spun his turret to Dora and said, "Get back!" Dora snarled and plunged a hand deep into Sigma's open socket, deeper than the shoulder joint, prodding past sharp, scraping wires and gobbets of warm grease like phlegm until her fingers wrapped around a hard bar that was either metal or composite. She clamped her hand around it, braced her right arm against the boxcar door, and leaned back hard, driving through her hips.
"Pull!"
she gasped, but she still felt the impact of Sigma's running feet through her arm. She refused to look back for the man who chased after them, yet more sparks jumped from the hoplite's body and fragments tore at her cheeks. She closed her eyes and heaved. She heard a clank at her feet, and somehow knew it was Sigma's hand digging into the door track. The tremor of foot impacts ceased to run up the bones of her arm, but then the entire weight of the hoplite's body, all 300 pounds, transferred to her spine. She groaned, face bled out white, and began to pitch forward through the opening. She wedged hard against the door, but it was no good. He was pulling her through, and there was nothing she could do to stop it. No way she could position for more leverage without dropping Sigma entirely, and the skin of her right hand felt like it was being peeled off where it held the door's edge, and her back throbbed like it would fold in half and crumple. Along the back of her neck and into her spine, she felt a sensation like small electric explosions, and she wondered if there was some sort of nerve damage happening back there. An arm encircled her waist as she began to lose her center before she was launched from the car like a bullet, and when she opened her eyes to look down, there was another arm jutting out between the door and her right calf, the hand hooked under the remaining intact arm. Giles yelled, "Pull, Dora! Pull!" She tilted her head back to look at the ceiling of the boxcar, clamped her teeth, screamed, and shoved through her legs into the floorboards. From very far away, she thought she heard Giles screaming as well, but then it was drowned out by the grinding of Sigma's body pulled over the edge of the doorframe. Starbursts exploded within her vision before the world began to leak away from her mind. She collapsed atop Giles with a silent huff of air, and Sigma, scrambling now along the floor of the car, took her arm with his remaining hand and pulled her back further from the door. Giles got to his feet, standing over them both, looking over her now, panicked, and looking down at her motionless form. No, not motionless. Her arms were twitching and jerking in small fits. She was making fists with her hands and looking off to some point above the crown of her head, and her arms jerked in short, trembling punches. Giles turned toward the door, intending to grab the edge and shove it closed. He saw the round face staring back at him, framed in the bottom corner as though peeking out from cover. There was enough light to see the eyes, and they were a dead, formless black, devoid of iris or white, and the round, feminine cheeks jiggled slightly as he ran in time with the train. Beside his head was a green overlay that said Belin, and underneath the name, Warning. Belin's hand appeared over the floorboards holding a pistol. The closest weapon was Sigma's detached arm. Giles dropped to a knee, grabbed it by the wrist, and swung it into the side of Belin's head. The remainder of the shoulder ball impacted the pistol, knocking it into Belin's face, and when Giles pulled the arm back, he saw a gash running from the temple to the top lip. The man named Belin did not grunt or cry out when he was hit. Giles screamed for him then, something primal, and struck again. He took Sigma's wrist in both hands and swung to drive a coffin nail, bringing it down again and again, knocking Belin's head down behind the edge of the door like a whack-a-mole. It came back after each impact, but each time it came back, it came a little less. The laceration widened until the nose and then the mouth as well were hidden behind a slick red flap of skin, and still he did not cry out. Giles screamed again and brought the arm against Belin's head in a wide, sidelong arc. The shoulder annihilated against the skull, shuddering into fragments until Giles held only a hand, a wrist, and a few bits of wire and metal bars jutting forth like bones and tendons. Belin had disappeared from view, and when Giles looked out the door to see what had happened, he caught the shape of a detached leg flopping away from the boxcar's wheels. It rolled over itself as it tumbled down the gravel, came to a stop in the low trough of dirt, and bled out blackly into the dust. It was the only sign of Belin. Anything else had passed from sight under the guillotine wheels. Giles dropped the remainder of Sigma's hand on the boards, fell to his hips, and panted great gulps of air.
He breathed deeply for a moment, then turned to his hands and knees and scrambled beside Dora, who was now calmly blinking up at the dark overhang of the boxcar's ceiling. Giles searched until he found the layer that would expose her heartbeat, but there was nothing. He remembered Sigma had said the rattle of the train would drown out her pulse, and grabbed for her hand. Searching, he found her at the knuckle of her thumb and at the wrist, and waiting, felt the pulse was constant and strong. "Are you all right?" he gasped. She nodded. "What happened?" He felt her hand turn in a circle, then saw her do the same with her feet. She looked up at him and said, "Think I passed out."
"You passed out?"
"Yeah. I hauled on the toaster about hard enough to disconnect my spine. The world blacked out around the edges, then nothing until now."
"You're okay?"
"I think so. Nothing hurts."
"But you can feel everything?"
"Oh, yeah, everything's buzzing still." "What happened? Where's the shooter?"
"Belin." "Still?" She was shocked.
She sat up gingerly, and Sigma helped her with his remaining left arm.
"Yeah, I guess he made it out of that wreck."
"Well, what happened to him now?"
"Dead, I think."
"You think?"
"Pretty sure. I hit him a few times and he went under the wheels."
"Do you think he's dead the way you did when Sigma buffaloed him as well?"
"He came out from under the wheels in pieces."
Dora looked at him as never before, and he felt embarrassed. He turned away. He thought of how Belin had taken those shots to the face over and over, and how he had said nothing. He had not called out or grimaced. He had responded to the assault in a way that made Giles feel nervous, but there was no way to understand it. He felt as though he was being examined by an unkind doctor, and turned to look down the dark throat of the boxcar. There were black blobs down at the other end. Giles blinked on the starlight, and in the green haze saw a handful of transients huddled up at the other end.
"How many are there?"
Dora asked.
"You can see them?"
"I see something. I can see you looking, too, and that's enough."
He counted twice to make sure he did not miss one hidden behind another.
"5 of them."
She whistled softly.
"That's a lot for one car."
"Will they be a problem, do you think?"
"Probably not. Probably just on the move looking for work," she said.
Then she raised her voice over the growing rattle of the train and called,
"Thanks for the help. What did you bring the hoppy round for, then?"
She stood carefully and tested her balance, wanting to be sure she could fight if needed. When she knew she could stand well, she said,
"You see the hoppy making arrests?"
No answer came from the back.
"Yeah,"
she nodded.
"Any balls back there?"
"Watch it, lady."
"Oh, fuck. Watch this, okay?"
She tugged her crotch at them and spat onto the floor.
"None here, and I still found more than any of you packing back there. More cock here than there, chicken shits. Lady, I'm telling you, you'll do nothing. Come up here or shut the fuck up. Come on. We'll even sleep the hawk. He's down a wing anyway. Well, come on. Here I am. Let's see those balls."
The men at the back of the car said nothing more.
"Yeah," she said again.
She sat down on the other end so they would have to cross the light coming in through the open door to reach her. Giles eyed the men nervously, but they all seemed to have lost interest. He checked on Sigma, found he was mostly all right, considering, and went to go sit by Dora.
"We'll sleep in shifts," she said,
loud enough he could hear her over the growing bang of the train, quiet enough that only he and Sigma could hear her at all. The train picked up speed after they passed beyond Chicago's boundary and made the southern plunge around Lake Michigan's tip. The banging got louder the faster they went, and soon there was only the banging filling out the small box world around them, and they were back to packing scraps of fabric into their ears to hold in the sanity. No one said anything after that. They rode through the night in silence, being by each other, feeling each other's presence. And Giles watched the man on the other side of the boxcar under a green, milky haze. They came through Cleveland 3.5 hours later and rolled to a ponderous stop beyond the yard.
Dora went to the door and pulled with all her strength to slide it up against the rail spike in the track so that it was only open by a foot, and the sick electric light from the yards overheads beamed a sliver up the floorboards. They all removed to the far corners, Giles, Dora, and Sigma to one end, and the hobos to the other, backs against the wall featuring the door so that the bull would have to lean all the way in to see them, and listened quietly. The silence of the night was broken by the occasional bash or squall. 20 minutes later, the bulls started running sweeps, and Giles had to shut off his starlight vision or be blinded when the flashlight beams bounced off the inside walls of their boxcar. The bulls searched lazily, never looking inside the cars, and Giles understood Dora's attitude to the bovine stupidity of those who were caught. After a while, the sweeps stopped, and the sound of feet crunching through gravel went away. Then it was just the occasional bangs between gaps of silence, sometimes a squeal, and the car would lurch beneath them. But there was much silence, and Giles's head was ringing again in the quiet. Out of propriety, they waited for the hobos at the other end of the car to begin speaking before they whispered to each other. Giles could see them glance across the floor suspiciously from time to time, but they did not seem to be building up the courage it would take to challenge his little group.
"Sigma, how are you?" Giles whispered.
Dora heard but did not understand him. He shook his head gently at her when she nodded the question.
"System's normal so far. He didn't get anything I can't do without. Missing the appendage is unfortunate but livable. In fact, it may help in the long run. The power demand on my battery is less now, so I'll last longer on this charge."
"I'm sorry, Sigma." Giles said this last out loud. He wanted the discussion secret before when he did not know if Sigma was in trouble, but now he did not care.
"Why?"
"I'm sorry because you lost that arm. We can't fix it."
"Don't bother apologizing to that thing," one of the hobos called from the corner. "It can't care whether it has two arms or three dicks."
"I have one of the former and none of the latter, sir."
"Oh, you don't say."
There was laughter in the shadows, and Giles struggled to contain his anger. In his mind, Sigma sent, "Easy. He's right. It's not really something worth the concern. I can track your heartbeat through the nodes. Calm."
"There are people like this in the south," Dora said.
They heard a bang from far, far away, then rolling thunder, as of many explosions happening at once, coming closer, and then the car lurched beneath them again.
"Assholes," Giles whispered.
"No, migrant workers. It's not as bad, though. Many of them are coming from Argentina and Peru now. They want the jobs in Mexico or to enlist in the cartels in Colombia."
"Is there much work in Mexico?"
"Yes, very much. The pay is not the best, but then where is the pay good anymore? But the work is there at least, and that's a start. The medical industry is booming there as well."
"Yes," Giles sighed.
"Not here?" she asked.
He shrugged.
"In some ways, but it's changing faster than anyone can keep up with. Surgeries have all been robotized now. Most nursing, too. They're still using human doctors for analysis, diagnosis, and such. Research, too. That's all done by humans. The pharmaceutical business is always booming. But the nuts and bolts work? No. Automation here, there, everywhere."
"You're a crazy people," Dora said sadly. "They don't have the robots down south as much. They do in the hospitals, yes, for the surgeries and the running of the labs, just as here. But that is where the line has been drawn for the pensadores. The medical field, and only the medical field. They have older ones for the other work, the manufacturing and such, but they need the humans to tell them what to do. They've been able to hold off the thinkers, though, in Mexico. The other countries aren't a problem either. Argentina, Chile, Peru. There's no money to bring them in. The thinkers. The pensadores. They have the money in Mexico, but there is enough control that the government can hold them out."
Giles wanted to say something to this, but could think of nothing.
"I don't know why you let them happen," Dora said, shaking her head. She sounded sad, perhaps sad for Giles, perhaps sad for everyone. "You saw it coming."
He sighed, now tired, and wished to be anywhere else but in the car.
It's different here. You must understand. Here, the problems are always too big. Everyone knows a thing is a problem, always, and they know it should be fixed. Everyone knows how to fix the problem, too, and each one has a different way to do it, so they shout over which way is best. Many of the people are part of a kind of super-consciousness, what we call corporations, and they like to behave as though they are driven by a guiding principle, but principle is not a thing the system supports. Did you know, Dora, that a corporation is required by law to do the thing that nets the greatest gain to its shareholders, its investors? If it does not, the people driving the corporation are ousted and new ones are put in place.
I didn't know that.
Yes, it's true. And so that's the guiding principle right there. Do whatever thing that maximizes the number. Chase the number religiously. They'll put out a statement that says, we believe in such and such and so, and that's all very well and good. But they can only believe in it so long as the number is maximized. The religion must not be violated. These aren't bad people either. They're mothers and fathers, sons, daughters, brothers. They're the people we live with and see every day. But the law compels them. And sometimes the law does not align with principle. And then you have the ones who build it all. The inventors, the engineers. They create things the corporations must use to maximize the number. And these things, these inventions, maybe they're simple in concept, but the simple things are what you can take, mold, and combine in different ways. And then you watch what the numbers do. And if the numbers minimize, you change the combination. But if the numbers maximize, you tweak it just a bit. You massage and adjust the combination until you're squeezing out every last hundredth of a percent, and by then, maybe what you're doing with these inventions isn't so great, but the religion is upheld. And so on it goes.
But your government, Dora said.
They won't stop. They're paid by the corporations.
They what?
Not directly. And directly. In several different ways they are. You must understand the government cannot produce anything. It cannot produce wealth, but it needs wealth to survive. The government is a thing that must grow, just like a corporation. It grows for its own sake, but because it cannot produce wealth, it must consume it. Government only consumes and grows, always. The government grows by consuming taxes, which it takes from people, just as they do in the South. But this works less and less, and today it works barely. The government now gives more than it receives in taxes because so many are out of work. They must supplement, and they do so through the corporations. Can you see the problem? Strangle the corporations and the government strangles itself. Corporations must be allowed to maximize their profits, their numbers, or the parasite dies.
Christ, Dora said.
Engineers and executives, building things, whether they should be built or not. And then being compelled to use them because failing to use them violates the religion. And now here we are. In the first technology boom, well before the autonomous robots came, but after the workforce was saturated with technologists, people could retreat into the skilled labor market. There came a point when there were far too many engineers, too many programmers, but that was okay because there was an underserved market. People went back and found the professions that were left behind. And many made a damn fine living working with their hands, doing the things everyone else had forgotten how to do. This was called the information age. Then, in the AI boom, that market disappeared. It's not gone completely, but it's shrinking. You needn't pay a wage to a robot, and the robots are now smart enough to do the skilled work, the work only a human could do not so long ago. And now economies of scale are beginning to apply, and it becomes worse every day.
Economies of, she asked.
It becomes cheaper to make new robots than to train people. The automation coming out of China and Korea now, it becomes very much cheaper.
She sighed.
You're not just crazy, you're sick. It'll find the South eventually as well.
No chance.
No? What did you just say a while back? Medical is booming?
That's right.
And all the supporting industries, mining, shipping, and so forth, to make it all work.
Yes.
Giles nodded and looked away.
Only a matter of time.
I can't imagine, she said.
They want to compete at some point, Dora. Right now, they must be insulted because of the ways in which they don't comply.
I know a thing or two about this, you see. The rumor here is that you can grow an entire body in Cancun. I know all our rich go down there for their organ replacements. It's too damned expensive to have them grown here. Here they use CNT lattices for bone or tissue growth. It's very expensive to do because of how the insurance system works. There? I hear you just grow the body. Grow it without the brain. The stem is there, the lower functions. But the shell is empty, and you just harvest what you need.
Illegal as hell, of course, but who cares about the WHO? The UN is a joke without a punchline.
She pulled away from him and shuddered.
They would never. Or, what if they did? We could just shut the robots off if it becomes bad.
Oh. Then why haven't we shut them off up here?
She sat up and looked at him, annoyed now.
Well, why haven't you? You can tell what the problem is. Fix it. Get rid of them.
You can't, Giles sighed. You can't uncreate a thing.
What do you know about World War II? Anything?
A little.
Do you know about the bombs they dropped on Japan?
Yes, a little.
It was the first and only time atomic weaponry was used in a war, Dora. And I think after that, the world hasn't been right ever since. Everyone knows what it means now, because everyone has them. Everyone knows if we start firing them off at each other, the world will become covered in the shadow of its own destruction, and the plant life will all die out under the shadow, with all the animals, including us, to follow soon after. Even knowing that, we continue to point these weapons at each other. Why haven't we gotten rid of these? Knowing what it means to use them. Why don't we just throw them all away?
She said nothing.
Robots don't do anything but make the people in charge wealthier. You think they'll get rid of automation for that, when they won't pitch out the weapons that could kill them and everything else, everything on the face of the earth?
No. Not likely.
She shifted in her seat angrily, facing the other side of the boxcar.
Not in the South. They're not sick. They won't let it happen there.
Sure. I'm sure they wouldn't. You're right.
You're right, of course.
Dora crossed her arms and began to rub her biceps vigorously with each hand. Giles smiled sadly and was silent. From the other end of the train, one of the hobos said,
I think it was when they gave them thumbs that it all fell apart. Before that, we could still claim that one superiority, the utility of the thumb. But then they gave thumbs to the tin cans as well, so they could use all them same tools as we used. Them tools didn't have to be redesigned for the robots to use, not with their fucking thumbs. Thumbs like the one that bastard has right there.
He pointed at Sigma and sneered. Quietly, the turret whirled and locked onto his position. Giles placed a hand on Sigma's remaining arm as though the hoplite would surge forward in a rage and asked,
What did you do for a living?
Mechanic, the man said.
Well, this hoplite was never a mechanic. He didn't take your job. You needn't call him a bastard.
Him? Is it? That's only a machine.
Maybe, Giles said.
For you he is, maybe. For me he's already saved my life many times. For me he is a he.
He saw the shadows shift at the other end of the car and brought the starlight vision back. One of the men back there was larger than the others.
He turned to face Giles, and in a deep voice said,
Well, I was a cop, and hoppies such as that took my job. And I say it's a fucking bastard.
Giles felt Sigma's arm stir, rotating smoothly on silent mechanisms. Sigma spoke, and to Giles it was a wonder that the hoplite's outside voice matched the voice inside his mind so perfectly. It was familiar in unconsidered ways.
Did you ask to be a policeman?
I did. Wanted to be one since I was a boy, long as I can remember.
I didn't ask to be a hoplite.
Sigma went silent, as rigid as fused iron, and Giles understood he had slipped into a reduced power mode. No one else spoke. They had all gone very quiet and still, as Sigma had gone still. The boxcar banged a final time, filling them all with the ring of metal, and then they lumbered due east, finally embarking on the last leg into Syracuse. Dora leaned her head against Giles' shoulder, and Giles leaned his against the rattling wall at his back. Then he leaned it forward when the shaking of the car brought his headache around with a renewed madness, and finally rested his head against her crown. It was comfortable there, against the kinked springs and coils of her hair. He thought about the man he had killed, Belin, and was bothered. He was bothered greatly by the fact that the killing of Belin had not bothered him at all. Giles blinked out the lens starlight. He knew it would not be needed.